Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit in creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show. And today we have a very special guest. Before I introduce her, we have some new sponsors, and you will see their banners going through the show. So I didn't want you to be surprised. We're very excited about them and we welcome them, but it's a new thing that we're trying. So just take a look and see who's sponsoring our show these days. We will have an interim commercial, but for now I'm going to bring up Tracy Hunt. Well, first I'm going to introduce her. Tracy has enjoyed a lengthy career as an operations manager for several law firms and has a side business as a personal trainer and wellness coach. She considers herself an ambassador in the global community of transformation and is passionate about prison reform, reducing homelessness, and supporting incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people. Hunt is actively involved in the Skid Row Running Club, law enforcement, veterans causes, the Compassion Prison Project, and the Transformation Foundation. Her commitment for the world is by 2030, all people will be honored and recognized as family. And welcome, Tracy. That's beautiful. I love that. We'll be honored and recognized as family. All right. So where do you want to start? Do you want to start with how you got interested in the prisons, or do you want to go back farther?
Well, I would love to start with yesterday. I was in prison yesterday. And when you said my commitment for the world, I got really moved because I was able to share with the group of men that were gathered there in the room, about 30 of them, that, you know, why I come into prison. And it is for them to be with them. I consider it an honor, and that I love each of them. And you know, I got moved and they got moved, and they are not allowed to get moved in prison. One of them said to me after, he's like, we can't do that here. You cannot be vulnerable. And I really get that. And so there's a big missing out in that population in particular, for people to express their emotions other than anger or, you know, whatever it is that's typical.
Now, when you say you were in prison, some people might not know what that means.
Yes.
You know, obviously, I know that you visit the people in prison and make a difference there, but what would you like to tell people so they can understand it a little more?
Yeah, sure. So the first time I ever went into a prison was in 2019. And I went to San Quentin with my running club, the Skid Row Running Club. And that day just changed my life, being able to connect with these men that I never thought I would feel like these are people I wanted to be with and talk to. And I could somehow relate to, even though I've never, you know, done anything, any kind of criminal activity. There was something, you know, they're human beings. And when I left that day, it just touched me so deeply. And the fact that I was able to leave and go home and be free, you know, and I continued to think about them. And then I got the opportunity a couple of years ago with the Compassion Prison Project to go into prisons on a regular basis. And so I've been doing that ever since. And yesterday
before you go, how did you happen to go there in 2019? Like, what was this running club and why? Like, because if I was in a running club, I don't think I would end up as a prison. So I'm just wondering, like, how did that happen? You know,
okay,
like,
so
was it random or where? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Skid Row Running Club was formed by, are started by Judge Craig Mitchell, a criminal court judge in Los Angeles. And we are based out of the Midnight Mission here in Los Angeles, which houses people who are in recovery from drugs and alcohol, who've been released from prison and are looking to get back on their feet, you know, people who are homeless, essentially. And it's generally a 2-year program. So Judge Mitchell started a running club there back in 2012.
And how did you get involved with the running club? Where are you getting there?
Yeah, well, thank you. There's actually a documentary about our club called Skid Row Marathon. And I saw that movie in 2018. And it touched me so deeply that just a couple days later, I was in Skid Row.
What is Skid Row?
It's an area of Los Angeles that is, I forget how many square miles. It's a, you know, not a huge area, but it is the most desolate, basically tent city, full of addicts, people living on the street, just terrible, terrible area. And I go there every week. I saw the movie and I said, you know what, I want to be with these people in the running club that are committed to making a difference.
So you just happened to see the movie and that's what did it.
I was not a runner. I still do not like running, but I've run many, many half marathons with the club and other races. I became a runner.
So just because of the movie, this all started. You happened to see the movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that was 7 years ago, all this has happened.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
That's amazing.
Total life transformation. And San Quentin State Prison has a running club called the Thousand Mile Club. And it's called that because there are many lifers in San Quentin. There used to be a death row there, no longer death row, but still men that are there for life, essentially. And it's when you're, you know, there for life, it's not hard to run 1,000 miles around the track. So every year they have a marathon in the prison, and our club got connected to them. So we go every year. We're going 2 weeks from yesterday. We'll be there to join their club. And it's such a wonderful opportunity. We run the track.
You're running inside the prison?
Inside the prison. And it's not just the running club. There's guys playing basketball. There's, you know, whatever else is going on. And we just navigate through all of it. And it's great to be able, when free people come into a prison, the men and women, we go to, you know, women's prisons as well, really appreciate it. You know, somebody gives their time to come in and let them know that somebody's thinking about them.
Wow. So did you have any people in your life that was involved with prison?
Nothing. Never.
It just came out of the blue and hit mm-hmm. your heart, right? Wow.
Well, I would say the impetus probably was growing up in the 60s in LA and seeing the, you know, living through the Watts riots, seeing the disparity between the races, really, you know, there was something very deep for me, you know, about that. And in prison, the overwhelming population is African American.
Mm. You know, I was reading, Tracy recommended this book, What Happened to You, by Oprah and,
Bruce Perry.
I guess he's a doctor, Dr. Bruce Perry. And it talked about, you know, no one. So in your, I'll try to explain it and tell me if I get this wrong. So in your brain, you know, in your cognitive brain where you're thinking, of course, no one's racist because that's not right and all that. But we have a something bias. What's it called? There's a bias. I can't remember the word now, but it's in the other part of the brain that we're not conscious of. And it said that more, you know, white people aren't as often to be arrested or whatever than other. And that's just the way the bias works. It's not even conscious, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's why? That there's so many more non-white in the prisons?
That I would say that's certainly a big part of it. Also the economic disparity. You know, if you don't have money, you're going to be forced to go out and figure out how to make money, selling drugs, stealing, whatever it is. You grow up in those kind of economic circumstances, and that's often where people turn to crime to feed themselves and their families.
And then they get caught.
Which, and interestingly, getting caught can often be a good thing. I've met many people in prison who say this is, you know, this is the best thing that could have happened to me. If I weren't in prison, I'd probably be dead. You know, when they continue to live that kind of life out on the street.
Now, does that have to do with the trauma? I know you read the book a while ago. I just finished it, so it's fresh in my mind. The trauma and the when someone's not regulated, does that have anything to do with it? Or would you just say
Absolutely.
That they don't have, you know, they're inheriting that culture or they're inheriting that, I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
they weren't regulated. I don't know. Where does that, why is that what they turn to? Is it because nobody else taught them differently?
I would say both. Trauma, definitely. Childhood trauma is a big, big part of it. And in the Compassion Prison Project, what we specifically look at is childhood trauma and ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, which are generally things that happen to a child under the age of 18, whether it's, you know, growing up, there's no food in the house. You don't have clean clothes. Your parents are on drugs. Nobody there to take you to the doctor. You're not safe. You don't feel safe. You want to get out. You know, how many of these young people are like, I left when I was 13. I had to get out of that house. What is a 13 going to do to, you know, make sure that they're eating? They're going to join a gang or they're going to, you know, go somewhere, but they're going to steal or whatever it is, you know. So yeah, the trauma is a very big part of, and there's a lot of trauma in prison. And it's not just the incarcerated people, the corrections officers also. That is generally why they might see that as a job opportunity. You know, they maybe grew up in that traumatic, well, they were in that maybe violent kind of household, and suddenly I can have some kind of power here. I've got the uniform. I can, you know, be the one who's in charge. I'm not saying that for every corrections officer, but we do have them come into our exercises as well. And they have just as much trauma. Recently, I asked one of the very young officers, what had you get into this? You know, what had you choose this career? And he said, well, my whole family is corrections officers. It's good pay. And, you know, I figured I'd do it. And you can't imagine the kind of trauma they see. You know, their lives are at risk when they're in prison. They see, you know, the incarcerated people stabbing each other, killing the drug overdoses, all that stuff. So they're constantly in this fight or flight mode as well, which is when you talked about regulating.
Yeah. And why are they stabbing each other?
The incarcerated people? Well,
yeah.
When you come from that culture, gang violent, you know, like I'm number one here, or no, we don't accept that particular gang. Your job is to go, if you want to be with us, your job is to go kill them. That kind of thing. Yeah.
Oh.
But I wanted to get back to the regulating.
Yeah, so that's a big word that I'm learning.
It is.
It's huge.
You know, when I think about, like, if I'm driving my car and all of a sudden somebody cuts in front of me and I have to slam on my brakes, you know, and I'm like, oh my, you know, that's a fight or flight response, right? And it takes something to, like, bring yourself back down. So most of us are able to you know, do that, bring ourselves back down somehow. But when you're living in prison and you have that going on all the time, you've got to watch what's going on. Being able to learn some regulating, you know, whether it's tapping, you know, or, you know, some type or meditation, something that'll bring you back to that state of calm is very important.
Yeah.
Because it has a huge impact on the health.
Well, you know, I'm doing this education series and I just interviewed one of the teachers who said he teaches his kids when they're not regulated that there's, you know, he gives them three options. So they actually know, these are like kindergarten kids, they actually know when they're not, they can go to a quiet place, they can move, if the school allows it, they can go in the hallway and move, they can dance, like it says rhythm is big, mm-hmm. and they can actually help each other regulate, which I thought was so cool because I had never even heard that word, yet these kids are already learning how to tell when they are that, you know. And in the book, it says, you know, you're called into the office and your boss yells at you. And all of a sudden your brain's going, oh, my God, you know, going crazy. But then what it uses as an example here is that person can go talk to three or four of their community members, get validated, and then their brain slows down. They get back into their cortex where they can think. And then they're calm. And I was like, I never saw it that way. All I know is sometimes I'm like crazy. I know you don't like that word, but I'm not rational. And I never knew why. But I guess for some people, like the people that you were talking about who didn't have a safe growing up, they didn't have the people taking care of their, what is it, hunger, you know, they weren't safe.
Right.
Have they ever learned to regulate?
You know, I, one of the other projects I do, yesterday when I was in prison, the Skid Row Running Club formed a running club in a local, you know, kind of a local prison here. It's an hour plus drive for me from LA. And it's called the Born to Run Club. And we are currently in our third cohort. And it's become so popular. We have a waiting list of 100 guys wanting to get in this club. And I would say it's not just about the running. We run for an hour and then we're in the classroom for an hour. So it's about they built this community with each other now.
Yeah.
And, you know, the exercise is great, certainly, because that's, you know, they're working on something. We're going to have a 10K in a couple of months, a race, and they're going to get medals, you know. So that's
prisoners, ex-prisoners, exactly.
They're currently incarcerated. Uh-huh.
Oh, so yes. They're in now. Okay.
Oh, yes,
okay.
They're in now. And I forgot where I was going with this.
So there's a waiting list. You're going to do the run, the Born to Run cohort about regulating.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Thank you. So a couple weeks ago, I was on the track with one of the guys and he, you know, I was just listening to him talk. And he said, I learned to regulate by cutting myself. Now, cutting, to me, that's generally something that girls do. So I was a little surprised. And my response was, I'm so sorry that you had to go through that. And he was like, probably not used to that response, you know, that I actually got that impact. And I saw him yesterday, too. His name is Alan. And I looked over at him and there was an opportunity to share. And he actually raised his hand, and which is really great because it tells me that how important listening is. You know, this happened a couple of weeks ago when he shared with me. But he got it. Like he realized somebody cares about me and is interested in my life.
You know, I thought it was fascinating what the book said about that was that for people who've never been regulated and they cut themselves, it's like taking an opioid.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this wonderful feeling. Now, if you're regulated and you cut yourself, it hurts. But if you're dysregulated, for some reason, that gives you this euphoria. And for people, or that's why people who, you know, I had a friend who was probably not very regulated and, you know, abused growing up and foster care and all that stuff. And he became a drug addict. For him, it was like the first time he was like, wow, like it was great. They've never felt safe or.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's understandable why they get addicted even to the cutting. I never understood that because you think, why would someone do that? But it's the first time that they feel good.
That and maybe
isn't amazing.
They're not present to their feet. You know, you have when you're scared all the time, you're going to block your feeling. You know, you're going to maybe go out of your body or whatever it is. So
appreciate, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. And so that cut the feeling of, you know, I'm just making this up since I'm, you know, but I can imagine just feeling that you're feeling something.
Mm. Right. I mean, they probably, if you can't run as a kid, you can't run because you need to stay home because you're surviving, then you. So you can't the fight or flight, but so you disassociate and you go inside where you can be safe in your own mind.
Yes.
So then how would you ever get present to what's happening? Do you know what I mean? Like you said, that might have been his first time being conscious of it or something, right? I don't know.
Right. And when you talk about these children that are being taught, you know, I know how difficult it is for me to pause. You know, something happens and I'm like, ah, you know, to like go, oh, wait a minute. So learning that as a kid, that is so great.
Isn't it? I'm so excited about the you'll see, well, you won't see today, but the sponsor, Kikori, it's social emotional learning. Mm-hmm. And it's all about bringing the kids, you know, when they're dysregulated, bringing them back into their heart or bringing them up to the cortex, you know, by introducing play. So this man, his name is Anderson, he uses it, but what he creates, like everybody's welcome, kind of what you're creating in the prison, like everybody matters. Everybody's heard. If you're struggling, this, you know, you help each other. There's no competition. There's no, I'm better than you. They're like a little family. And he sets it up in the first 2 weeks of the year. And I'm like, my God, that's like a model for everywhere, right? That everybody matters. You're not like just a stupid kid because you're dysregulated or you had trauma. So you didn't, it says when you have trauma, there are certain parts of your brain that don't get developed. So you could be 2 years old, but in kindergarten as a five-year-old, but you're not able to process. And he brings them up to speed. I mean, it's amazing, right?
That is really great. Taking
us off of the prison, but I find it so parallel. You know what I mean? These kids.
Right, right. Absolutely. Yeah.
So you were in the Born to Run. So the Born to Run cohort, so you have a group of people, you said there's a waiting list. Who's on the waiting list? Prisoners or?
Yes.
Or...
Yes. The incarcerated men, they want to get into this group and we'll all be waiting outside to get on the yard. We have yard time, 1 hour. So we wait for the, you know, first group to come off and then it's our time to go on. So while we're standing there waiting, other guys will walk by going to class or whatever. And they'll, you know, like, hey, how do I get in? How do I join you? Which is really great.
And is it dangerous at all for you to go in?
Well, I do not feel, in fact, that's one of the things I shared with them yesterday. I feel so safe with them. First of all, it's a level 2 prison. These guys all have release dates. They have not committed, as far as I know, you know, murder. It's possible they have, and they've just worked their way down to a level 2, which is really, you know, pretty safe. A couple months ago, I went to Pelican Bay in Northern California, which is pretty notorious for it was the most dangerous prison in California, maybe even it's pretty well known in the U.S. For a long time. It's definitely gotten safer. However, while we were there, the Compassion Prison Project, there were three separate incidents. The first one, we were in a room with these, you know, about 60 of the incarcerated men, something like that. And all of a sudden, over out right outside in the yard, I hear this, you know, bullhorn, get down, get down. And I'm like, and then I hear these shots fired. Now, they were rubber bullets, I'm sure, or a beanbag gun or something. They were not bullets, you know, real bullets. However, that like, oh, my God, you know, very close to where all of us were. And the guys were like, I got that they were all making sure we, the volunteers, were safe. So that was like, wow.
Like, what did they do?
Well, they sat, we stood up and went over to a separate area so that in case we had to get out, we could get out. They sat, but it was their being. You know, they were like, I was sitting with them and they were like, no, you go over there. And when it was over, they were like, this happens all the time. But I was like, oh my God. And then it happened again, you know? So, anyway, I felt safe with them.
Yeah. Wow.
Woo. And you do sign a waiver when you go in. Like, there's a no hostage policy, meaning if you get taken hostage, nobody's coming to your aid. You know, that is, I mean, it would be very rare, but it is a risk.
Wow. Wow. All right. So, and how many of you go in? How many of you?
Yesterday, there were two of us.
Yes. Two? And how many of them?
30. 30 men in the running club. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what we did this with this cohort, which is so amazing, we've empowered three of the guys to be the coaches. We were the coaches before. Now they're the coaches. So they run the show during the running part, the first hour. And it is so amazing to see them step up as leaders. It's really incredible.
Wow. Oh my God. So, all right. There's so much here. I mean, what have you learned? What have you seen? You know, why do you love it?
Certainly everyone deserves a second chance. I mean, I see my own biases. Another thing I do is expungement clinics. When people have record, you know, they're out, they have records. They have, you know, criminal records that they want to get cleaned up. So that when they fill out a job application, they don't have to check that little box that says, I had a felony or I've been in prison or whatever. Once you get your record expunged, you know, it's basically clean. Not that it's disappeared. So recently, I saw the guy's, you know, all his offenses first, and I totally made up who he was. Before I met him, then I got on Zoom with him and I was like, wow, this guy is not at all who, you know, the reason he had committed these crimes, completely not what I had made up. And so, you know, there's my bias.
And why did he commit the crime?
He grew up in a, you know, he got a DUI, grew up in a family that was, you know, they're all drinkers. Nobody taught him. You know, and it just went on from there. Trauma.
So when you, so can you expunge that?
Oh yeah, sure.
How do you do that? Why would they take that off the record?
Well, I write declarations. The people that are volunteering, we write declarations like this is, you know, this was his life. This is how he grew up. This is what happened to him. Bringing it back to not what's wrong with you, but what happened to you that led to this. You know, this is what happened to him. And this is who he is now. He's been sober for 9 months. This is what he's doing with his life and taking care of his mother or, you know, whatever it is.
Hold that thought. We're going to go to our commercial break and then I want to ask you about that. Okay, I'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Parents and teachers, imagine a classroom where every child belongs, where kids are seen, known, and part of a real community. That's the world Kikori creates. Kikori isn't just another program. It's hands-on, playful, and filled with activities kids love, all while building skills that matter for life. Confidence, kindness, resilience, and teamwork. Kids learn how to regulate themselves, connect with others, and discover the joy of learning that lasts a lifetime. And it works. Schools using Kikori have seen behavioral referrals drop by 25%, and teachers save hours of planning time. Whether you're a teacher building a safe, positive classroom, or a parent wanting your child to grow socially and emotionally, Kikori makes it easy to bring these life skills into everyday learning. So if you're ready to help kids grow stronger, kinder, and more confident, while creating a community where every child belongs, visit KikoriApp.com. That's KIKORI, where kids thrive together. Hey, it's Hillary from the Getting Real with Hillary Show. Life can be messy, raw, and real. And sometimes we're afraid to feel vulnerable. We're afraid to be that real self. Well, that's exactly what the Getting Real with Hillary Show and Getting Real Movement is all about, being our true selves. Every week, I bring you stories of transformation, authenticity, and hope. People getting real with their struggles, their faith, and their breakthroughs. So don't miss a thing. Subscribe to my weekly newsletter today. You'll get stories, links to everything new, and how to create a life you love every week. Directly to your inbox. You can also find my books on Amazon, my courageous and riveting memoir, The Second Piece of French Toast, in case you feel stuck in your life and want to get inspired. How I Came Out About My No Sex Life and My Marriage, and my second book, Real Talk. That one will get you speaking up in ways you've been too afraid to do so, and really creating amazing freedom. And my third book, How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun. The name is called Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. Find links to everything and subscribe to my YouTube channel, Getting Real with Hillary, and you'll find the links in the header. So visit, and you can also visit gettingrealwithhillary.com because the real you is worth it and wants to come out. And thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com, to Jerry Dale, who is a new sponsor. If you haven't seen his book, Music, Porn, and Jesus, it is a story of redemption, kind of similar to what we're talking about today. You can always get my books on Amazon. And again, if you see the little banners going by, that's our new sponsorship program. And we also have Ed Hagem, who also wrote a couple of amazing books, and his story from orphan to Wall Street mogul, unbelievable story. So we just love these people and we thank them for their support. And now I'm going to bring back Tracy. So when someone gets out, I know nothing about prisons, but I've heard that sometimes it's hard for them because they're used to that life. And sometimes they end up going back to prison because it's almost easier. They don't know what to do with themselves. Have you found that?
Absolutely. Well, I would say that people that are in a program like the Compassion Prison Project, which has an amazing program called Trauma Talks. It's a 16-week program that you learn about your childhood trauma, and being aware is so important. You know, like, oh, that's why this happened to me. And people that take classes that are empowering themselves and getting them ready to be released, they have a much better success rate. Certainly when there's a community, you have a family outside who is, you know, going to make sure that you are taken care of, because if you are released, and generally you're going to be released to a, I don't want to use the word halfway house. I hate that. You know, you're going to be somewhere where you're spending a year or two getting back into society. You got to figure out, how am I going to get a job? How am I going to make money? Where am I going to live? How am I going to pay rent?
But do they help them?
Yes. And then when you leave that place, then what? And yes, it is sometimes easier because of that familiarity. When you're in prison, you don't have to have a job. You don't have to worry about making money. You know, all those things. Somebody's telling you, this is when you get up. This is when you go to bed. This is what you're eating today. You know, there's another amazing movie called 26.2 to Life, which is about the 1,000-mile running club. Highly recommend it.
Wow.
And one of the guys gets out and is taken to a restaurant. And he's like, he's never been able to order a meal. So he's like, I don't know. What should I get? You know, you are given food. You're going to eat this. That's it. So just having a choice when you get out is, you know, a lot.
Yeah. Now, are most of the guys, you know, you hear about those really bad people. Are any of them not sorry? Like, would you say most of them are, you know, when they learn about their trauma and they learn about why, and they wanna come out and have a different life? Are there some who don't?
Not that I've come in contact with. I would say most people who are working on themselves, you know, willing to take on, not everyone's ready to do that, you know, as we know. But those that are, taking accountability, that's huge. And yeah, being, you know, saying, yes, I did this, and how can I pay for what I did?
Yeah.
You know?
Wow. I guess it's, yeah, being willing to take accountability and responsibility. I guess you would be ready to not be a victim who's going to blame someone else, or do you know what I mean? Because when you're go ahead.
Oftentimes, you know, like in the Skid Row Running Club, the people that are in recovery, most of them want to become drug and alcohol counselors. They've been there, so they know what it's like, and they have, you know, they had somebody support them. So they want to then give back. And same with a lot of these guys who are getting out. They know what it's like to be in prison. They do not want anybody else to, you know, especially the younger generation, to go through that. So they're going to be there supporting, making sure the communities are safe.
Wow. Now, would you say, given, you know, if someone grows up with a lot of trauma, that they would have trouble trusting?
Oh, absolutely.
Someone who says they have their best interests, like you, maybe, or some of the other people, like, how do you get past that? You know, because I would think, you know, even as myself, you know, things happened when I was young. It's like, I don't trust, blah, blah, blah. But then I hope, and then maybe I'm manifesting the same pattern. So then they screw me over again. Do you know what I mean? Like, how do you break mm-hmm. that so that someone can live with faith and trust, I guess?
Well, if you're talking about like me and someone else, it takes consistency, you know, showing up for the person, showing that you are your word. Like when you say, hey, yes, I will be there for you, that you are. Yeah. Continuity. Like, it's trust is a very tricky, because I even look at myself and at work, like, do I really trust this person? Am I really willing to share this with you that I know is going to put me at risk? Have we developed that kind of relationship yet? It definitely takes something.
Yeah. Now, did you just get a new job?
Mm-hmm.
And what are you doing when you're not doing the prison stuff?
I'm a human resources manager at a law firm. Yeah.
So that's very different, right? Wow.
It is, yes, because these are all professional people. And yes.
Do they know about your passion projects? Do they know?
I've shared with a couple of people. Mostly people, you know, like I'll say I was in prison yesterday, and people will laugh and go, oh, you know, oh God, or like, what do you mean? You know? So then I explain what I do, and mostly people are like, wow, that's really great. I wish I had time to do something like that. Or, you know, or aren't you scared? Or why are you doing that? You know, the various questions. Once in a while, people say, hey, how can I do that too? Which is great.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is kind of a whole different world. The professional life where people think they're dealing with life and death, you know, in the working world, like, oh my, you know, and it's like, really?
To get this brief out by 2:00.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting, right? Well, I guess, you know, you telling them what you do is part of sharing, right? It's part of you sharing your passions with the people at work, which does take something, you know, makes you vulnerable, yeah, you know?
Right. And having people be like opening up to like, oh, wow, I never thought about that.
Yeah.
Well, I never thought about people in prison before either.
Yeah. Well, I remember, when my father died, thinking, you know, because we go to clients and it's like, when I started telling people, because it wasn't like professional, but I started telling people and they started opening up to me about their experiences, and it created this whole bond. Mm-hmm. When you're, you know, appropriate, or I mean, this is getting real, you know, when I'm appropriate or, you know, trying to be the good one or whatever, there's no sharing, there's no connection. But when I started breaking the rules, my rules, a little bit, there was that bond. And they started telling me about their father, you know? And it and it created a connection, I think. Yeah. So, okay. What are some of the best stories that you have from going in to the prison, do you think?
Well, I remember that my first time in San Quentin, one of the guys that we had lunch together, and then he showed me his cell. And during lunch, he told me,
"You got to boy, do you have like a security guard with you or anything? Or you're just walking around
about prison?" There's corrections officers. Sure.
Okay.
But again, these are I don't want to say they've been chosen, but they've proven themselves to be
trustworthy,
safe.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wow. So you're walking around in the prison, going to the cells. That's amazing.
Yeah. So he told me what had happened, like his version of why he was in prison. And I thought, wow. Then I went home, did my research. And I thought, that's not quite, I don't think that's quite what happened. So it was interesting. And he's out now, which is great. And it goes back to the accountability thing. When you can tell yourself the truth about your life, mm-hmm. that's going to put you in a whole different space. So that's one thing I've learned.
So what was different about the two stories?
One was, it was somebody else's fault.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth from what I read was, no, it was your fault. You did that. So
did you ever talk to him or you didn't see him again?
No,
no.
I haven't seen him again. Okay. Yeah. No.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's happened a couple times, I would say. Yeah. I find that people that can really get to the truth and really say, that's what the parole board wants to hear. They want to hear taking responsibility. I did that. You know, the guys that are in there a long, long, long time, they haven't gotten to that place yet where they can say that.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I would say that's, yeah.
So you think they're afraid to admit it?
Not afraid, but I don't think it's a fear. I think it's, you know, yeah, not being ready. Like, I know there's things that I don't want to say about myself. Like, you know, why have I gained so much weight? Well, look at you ate the blah, 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 blah. Right. Well, that didn't really matter. You know, that couldn't be it. So it's like really taking responsibility, you know, being really straight about stuff. Yeah. And like, what's really impactful is being able to connect, like that deep connection, which blows my mind. You know, I get moved very easily. Like yesterday I was crying when I was telling the guys, you know, and so then they, you know, they're like, cause they're not used to that. So being able to do that one-on-one, one of the things we do it with the Compassion Prison Project, all kinds of exercises. And one is this one-on-one, you're sitting right there knee to knee with somebody. And it is so incredibly powerful. And this many times, like I'll be crying and this big man will just start crying. And one of them said to me, I haven't cried in 13 years. The last time was the day I was sentenced to prison, which is like, because, you know, holding all of that in, not being able to release.
Yeah. So what were you saying to him?
It's a meditation that we do that is really, well, I'm not saying anything, but it's in the background. It's like a spoken meditation.
Okay.
And we're just listening. And one person has their eyes closed. And the other person is looking at their partner. So for another thing, you don't close your eyes in prison. When you are in prison, you're not going to close your eyes because there's constant danger, right? So for them to be even able to close their eyes in front of somebody else. And even for me, when I'm sitting there in a chair and knowing for 2 minutes that somebody is, you know, looking at me with my eyes, you know, that's very vulnerable, right?
Wow. And who started the Compassion Prison Project?
Her name is Fritzi Horstman.
Okay.
She's a documentary filmmaker. She's won awards. She's an incredible human being. And her commitment is to have her program in every prison in California. And she's also branched out to like Ireland, you know, I can't think of the other countries right now, but.
And how did she come up with it? Like, how did she
experienced severe childhood trauma herself. And she read the book, The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk.
Okay.
And I don't think I said that right.
That's okay.
Van der Kolk.
We can Google it later. Yeah.
Yeah. And it just, you know, she was like, oh my God, this, you know, this is what happened to me. So then she learned about the ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. and created this program, Trauma Talks.
And does she do it other places, or did she just pick prisons?
She has done the I'm actually on the board of directors.
Oh.
Have done it in outside in the community as well. And it was really interesting because people in the community have just as much trauma.
Yeah. I think everybody needs this. I mean, from what I read in this book, it's like no one escapes. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess when you have that, I get, we would call it safety, or you're regulated, you learn to be regulated, and then you have a, like you have a small trauma, maybe you lose an election or you lose a game, you can regulate that because you're used to it. But if you haven't ever learned how to regulate, you don't even know you can't, you know what I mean? That's probably a space you don't even know about. You just don't even know. So anyway, I would think that program needs to be everywhere. I don't think Definitely. People know about this. I didn't even know the word regulation until I started talking to these teachers and this Kikori stuff. I had no idea.
That's so great.
No idea. So I think, you know, rather than judging people, if you say, you know, that's what the book says, what, instead of what's wrong with you, what happened to you?
Mm-hmm.
And then it explains it. But I think it's also, you know, they diagnose so many people as ADHD or whatever. They might not be. You know, then they're getting medicated and then they're not being taught how to learn because you need to.
Or present to their real feelings.
Yeah. And then they're labeled mm-hmm. and then they're off the grid, you know. They're given up on. And I think that's probably so everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't there be less people in prisons if people learned that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If we really took on childhood, like childhood is a place for learning, development, support. Yeah. And when something and kids being able to feel free to say, hey, this happened to me, instead of hiding it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what happens a lot. Like not being believed.
Right. Or
not having,
don't be angry, or don't be upset, or don't be whatever you are, but I am.
Right.
Now what's wrong with me? You know, and then they don't, right. It's not a safe space. Just a little thing. I don't think most of us were taught to be able to be our emotions. Do you?
Nope. I mean, I wasn't.
No. I thought I was fine. That's what I was supposed to be. Fine.
Right. To this day, my mom, who's 99, she'll say, you know, I mean, I grew up hearing her say, don't make me cry. Right. So like, cause I am very, and I thank God, allow myself to be emotional instead of I used to suppress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not, you know, a strong woman does not cry during a whatever. No, that is a strong woman, strong person being able to get moved and move other people.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a crier too. All right. Well, we are have 2 minutes to wrap up. So what would you like? What message would you like to leave people with? And, you know, I know you have a vision for the world.
Yes. Thank you. Look out for each other.
Hmm.
Yeah. You know, if you see somebody that needs help, ask them, how can I support you? Do you need support? How can I support you? We all have a little extra time to do that.
Hmm. And if you're activities, you know, commitments that you, or the groups that you're doing, if that took off, how would the world be in 5 years? How would you love to see it?
Gosh, people would be loving one another, you know, connecting in community. I don't want to say there wouldn't be, I don't want to use the negative, but abundance and health, joy. safety. People would feel safe.
Mm. It's beautiful. Anything else in closing, Tracy, that you want to leave people with?
Thank you, Hillary. Thank you. This is such a valuable platform for people to listen and learn.
Yeah. Thank you. And thank you for the work you're doing. I know you don't have to, but you're doing it. I know it speaks to you and it's your passion. So thank you for acting on it, not just talking about it, not just thinking about it, but really doing it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye, everyone. Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.